From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later today, a local gaming expert tells us ways recreational gamblers can improve their odds. But first, groups loosely affiliated with the Democratic and Republican parties teach the practices of democracy overseas. Both groups were founded in the early 80s. They work together and have offices in many countries. One of those groups is the International Republican Institute. Program officer Jamie Fisfis lives in the East Bay. He lived in Sacramento for several years working for Republican lawmakers and candidates. I spoke recently with Jamie Fisfis about his experiences teaching the mechanics of democratic politics in Serbia and Angola. Also joining me was Mary Beth Barber. She's communications director for the California Arts Council. Before that, she served on Governor Schwarzenegger's event planning team. Earlier this year, she was a guest lecturer for the International Republican Institute in Angola. I started by asking Jamie Fisfis about the connection between the International Republican Institute and the Republican Party.
There's no connection between the two, although most of the board of directors of the International Republican Institute are Republicans. There is also a National Democratic Institute that tends to be on their board of directors mostly Democrats, and the two institutes typically partner in each of the countries where they're working.
What's the history of the International Republican Institute? How did it come about, and why is it called a Republican Institute if it's not really directly affiliated with the party?
Well, knowing, understand that I've been with the Institute for about 3 years now. So it was formed in 1983 by then President Ronald Reagan. It's been chaired for quite some time by U.S. Senator John McCain. I don't know myself why they chose the name. I think being Republicans, and their vision for it was that they were going to work with their compatriots in the Republican Party doing overseas consulting and democracy trainings and things like that. That's probably the genesis of the name. I'm not actually sure of that, but it's my guess, yeah.
And the Republican and Democratic parties, of course, are always in opposition with each other on political matters. But here you have these two institutes that are loosely affiliated with the two parties, and you say that they work together, usually they partner together?
Yes. In Angola, where I was earlier this year, we actually share an office. NDI, the National Democratic Institute, they are responsible under a contract from USAID for developing civic society, local NGOs. IRI, as it does in many countries, has the portion of the USAID contract in that country which covers political parties. I used to live in Belgrade, and in that country, we both worked with political parties and civic society. So it varies depending on what country you're in and what kind of contracts you have with USAID, the Agency for International Development, which is taxpayer funded.
The Democratic Party and the Republican Party have traditionally had countries that they were more interested in, usually depending on the nature of the government there, whether they tended to be more sympathetic or less sympathetic to it. Did the Republican and Democratic institutes ever carve up the world according to their own field of partisan interest?
No. Actually, the genesis of IRI and NDI in their current form was we all work under grants from USAID, and it's really USAID who we work for. There was another organization called National Endowment for Democracy, which is also a so-called donor. And it is those organizations which decide where the funding is going to be under guidance from Congress. So Congress says, okay, we're going to do democratic consulting in post-war Serbia to make sure that, for example, that we don't have a return to totalitarian government. So USAID then puts out a contract for political assistance. And usually IRI and NDI will compete for those contracts and roughly split it. So we're in almost always the same countries working together.
That's Jamie Fisfis, program officer for the International Republican Institute. That's a nonprofit pro-democracy organization created originally by President Reagan in 1983. Also with me is Mary Beth Barber. She was a guest lecturer for the IRI's democracy training program in Angola earlier this year. Her day job is director of communications for the California Arts Council. Mary Beth, what were you teaching and who were you teaching in Angola?
Basic communication strategy for political parties is what I was teaching. And in in the case of the people who I was teaching there, there were a number of different groups. The primary one that I was working with was a group of women that came from all of the different political parties. I also taught other workshops with, specific political parties. But the one that I really had a lot of fun with and focused on was the group of women that came from basically all spectrums, older, younger, some new political parties and some of the established ones.
Are you, in that context, teaching or aiming to teach basic democratic values and or the way American political machinery works, which in theory serves democracy?
Well, you can't teach in a country like Angola the way it works in the United States because it's not going to apply to them and it's not going to help them. Instead, it's what I tried to focus on was more some of the basic ideas of if you have a candidate who's going to run for office, how do you get the message out? How do you get people to understand what your candidate is all about? And if you're an American and thinking about the way the United States works, well, it's not going to apply in Angola. So instead, you have to come back to some very, very basic concepts of how do people communicate to each other? How do people learn about things in a country like Angola? So in the United States, you might say, do television ads. Well, that's not going to hit the bulk of the people in Angola. Instead, it's going to be a different format.
What kind of questions do political workers in Angola, say, have of you who works, you worked for Governor Schwarzenegger, you're with the California Arts Council, you have some fairly high-profile political jobs here now and in the past. What kind of questions do they have for you that would help them?
Well, let me see. Let me give you an example of the type of training that I started with. First, I didn't want to concentrate on the candidates that were in Angola because that would just turn into a political diatribe about who was better and who was worse. So I took a country that they were familiar with, Brazil, took two candidates that were very different from each other, and had them, like two teams of people separating after introducing the idea of these two candidates, and just said, okay, let's talk about different events that you are going to do in order to get these two very different candidates to, you know, present themselves to the public. My knowledge about what can happen after you present yourself. So if you take an economist and you put them in the middle of a slum in Rio, they're going to barely make it out alive. Well, these are some of the mistakes that these two teams hypothetically made of positioning their candidates in the wrong places. That's the kind of training that I was doing. And that's sort of what I was focusing on, was really critical thinking, much more than very specific things to do that would only relate to the United States.
Were you training people from more than one party at the same time?
When I was training the women, yes.
Yes. How did they get on with each other in this context?
They were great. Actually, the women's group was very, very active. I also found out afterwards that I had some non-political people in there. Some of the women had some experience, and some of them were just now getting involved in the process. And a lot of the questions that I had after the seminar dealt much more with not just political issues, but okay, here's one example. I am a medical student who wants to continue my education, and right now I can't find the funding. How do I find the funding? And that's all part of the process as well. I mean, in a country like Angola or anywhere, you know, government and business and education is all mixed in. And again, I tried to, in terms of, you know, the one individual who came to me, tried to think, give her some critical thinking tips, like, you know, find a class and get on the internet kind of thing.
What did you know about Angola before you went there? And what did you bring away with you about Angola?
I didn't know a lot when I was accepted to be a guest lecturer. My skill set had been Brazil, so I did speak some Portuguese, which I think was the initial interest from IRI, as well as my political background. But I did a lot of research. And what's interesting is the research that we get from the United States really focused on the problems they had had there, especially the civil wars that they had had. Once I was there on the ground, yes, you could kind of feel the tension that there was around, but there had been, you know, decades of peace. I still remember going on the internet and looking at information from a respectable website, I don't remember which one it was, and then realizing the information was 10 years old and dealt with a war that had basically stopped 5 years prior. So it was really it was interesting. What I learned when I was there was that the people were very, very interested in progressing towards a better society and democracy. And I was really impressed, like with this medical student, with how, given the situation that they're in, how sophisticated they actually were.
That's Mary Beth Barber. Jamie, you have also been working in Angola, but when you left Sacramento to work for the International Republican Institute, the first place you went to was Belgrade. Is that right?
Right.
What
Belgrade,
was that like?
Serbia. Very different from Angola. Belgrade at the time was recovering from the NATO bombings. It was trying to find its way with a new coalition that had replaced the regime of Slobodan Milosevic. And my primary role there was to work with political parties that were reform-minded and to try to get them to think critically about what sort of issues they would be relating to people, how they would organize their parties in an effective manner to get reelected. Unfortunately, the prime minister that we were working with was assassinated, I believe, the fourth month I was there. And the country went through another very difficult period. They went into a state of martial law. It was really a grim time, and there was a lot of question about whether or not the new democracy was stable enough to withstand the assassination of the prime minister. And we worked very hard with the reform-minded politicians that were there to tell them, hey, stay on the course. We did a lot of polling and focus groups, and we showed them that the people wanted them to continue the original course of democratization and modernization of their economy. So it was our information that we used to give to them and say, hey, don't turn around. Keep electing good people. And in fact, they did go on to survive some very narrow elections where the former Milosevic political party came within a hair's width of retaking power, which would have been another international crisis. So it was a very different environment than we have in Angola, where they're running up to their first elections since 1992. In Serbia, there seems to be an election every 6 months.
Does the training that you offer, and presumably that the Democratic Institute offers, are there countries where it's not well received or even not welcome?
Sure. Every country where we work in, we have to arrange a bilateral agreement with the host government. And every country has different restrictions on the type of trainings that we can do. In the countries that I've worked in, we work pretty fluidly with the government. That doesn't mean that the government always likes what we do. If they don't like our trainings, they'll tell us to stop them, and we have to stop. I mean, we work there under an agreement. But in most cases, they're happy to have us there. It's a sign of their cooperation with the U.S. It's a sign of their relationships with the U.S. that we're able to function there. And typically, the U.S. is not the only country that has NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which is what we are called. They're working with political parties. The Germans have a very prominent one, Konrad Adenauer Foundation, which also works with political parties in these countries. And whereas maybe during the Cold War, it was a little more difficult to work in these countries. Now it's a lot more open.
Mary Beth, is this a kind of Peace Corps for political people?
I guess you could say that. I hadn't thought about that.
It sounds like a stimulating and even fun thing to do. I'll let you talk.
Well, yeah. I mean, I definitely had a great time. I can say that I was scared to death going over there. I didn't know what to expect. And between the IRI staff and the enthusiasm of the people that I was teaching, I mean, I would definitely go back. Whether or not it's a Peace Corps for political training, yeah, I mean, I guess that it's democracy training and critical thinking training. For what I saw in Angola was that they hadn't had a lot of exposure where they had the choice to go out and do what they wanted to do themselves. That, you know, they've only had one election in 92 or 94, 92,
yeah.
As Jamie said. And the world is open to them what they want to do. They just weren't, you know, a lot of people aren't sure how to proceed and how to get the word out and how to convince people that their candidate is the best. And I think that's sort of the difference here, that before everybody was told, you know, you must do this and you must do that. And now it's instead a situation where rather than forcing people to think or act a particular way, it's a convincing world. And that was what I was trying to communicate to them, that if your candidate is right, you will be able to convince them that this candidate is the right person. Is the difference between a totalitarian government and a democracy.
Yes. Well, we've talked about Angola and Serbia. Jamie, you've also worked in Iraq. Is that right?
I haven't been to Iraq. When I was in Belgrade, I had to develop a series of trainings and seminars that were formally presented in many different countries, not just Belgrade. It turns out that they were also used in Iraq to train the local populace, the political activists, if you will, prior to the elections that we just had in January of 2005. IRI does have a number of people who are Americans who live in Iraq working for IRI, and they do the trainings on the ground there. But I've been in Angola most recently, but my trainings and seminars that I develop are also used there as well.
Does it affect the ability to operate of people like International Republican Institute staff in Iraq when it was their own government that was, the American government that was responsible for the overthrow of the totalitarian government? Does it enhance their stature, or does it make it harder?
I can speak directly to that because our situation was somewhat parallel in Belgrade. In Belgrade, we had been, you know, principally behind the NATO bombings just years earlier, in my case, 3 years earlier. So there was a little more space. But I can tell you that you work in these countries building personal relationships, and the personal relationships typically supersede whatever feelings people may have towards your country. I ran into people in Belgrade who did not like the U.S., and I ran into people who liked the U.S., and I ran in, and I know the people in Iraq run into the same thing. I think the thing is that if you want to function effectively in these environments, you have to be yourself. You have to show an understanding of their culture. I had to learn the languages in the countries that I went to. I couldn't just walk around, you know, blathering away in English to them. I had to learn Serbo-Croat. I had to learn some Portuguese. So the attitudes, you function mostly at the individual level. And I think in that sense, you can remove yourself from some of the geopolitical issues. However, the embassy has to deal with them and USAID has to deal with them whenever there's a spat between the two countries, your host country. So you can stay away from it as long as you focus on your job and don't bring politics into your job on a regular basis. You have to be nonpartisan.
My guests are Jamie Fisfis, who's program officer for the International Republican Institute, a nonprofit pro-democracy organization. He worked in Sacramento for several years for several Republican lawmakers and candidates. Also here is Mary Beth Barber, who was a guest lecturer for the IRI in Angola in February this year. She's currently director of communications for the California Arts Council. Jamie, you edited a publication about using focus group research in places recovering from war or a totalitarian government. What role do focus groups play in places recovering from trauma?
They can play a tremendous role, as a lot of our expert contributors to that pamphlet indicated. One of the things that we bring to these countries is the theory that in a democracy, you have to be listening to people on a regular basis. And so focus group techniques where you bring people into a room and they listen and they talk about political issues so that you can hear what attitudes are. We teach the politicians we work with, hey, you need to be listening to these people, whether things are great or whether things are awful. And so what the International Republican Institute did was put together a number of experts who had worked in countries like Iraq, who had worked in Romania, Slovakia, and we asked them, okay, you had bombs going off outside your walls. What made people willing to talk to you openly to a camera sometimes about their political views? And we learned a lot about techniques to encourage openness amongst the contributors and to so that you get real information, and so that the politicians will then use this and try to tailor their programming to what the people are looking for.
People people on the street, I think, make fun of focus groups sometimes that that they're one of the things, quote unquote, wrong with modern politics, that, you know, an otherwise attractive candidate is focus grouped into blandness. Mm-hmm. Do you ever worry that you're bringing political tactics and tools to other countries that maybe aren't in the long term healthy or productive?
Well, you know, we like to say that when we go over there encouraging democracy, we bring good and bad, in the sense that all of these tools can be used for good or bad. We try to focus on the element of focus group research, for example, which focuses on the politicians listening. One of the things I think that the listeners should understand is that many of these countries are not fighting over, for example, Social Security reform and whether there should be privatization of accounts or not. They're fighting over life and death. They're fighting over very basic economic progress. And they're probably a long way from the sort of manipulative focus group usage that we've come to fear in the U.S. from our politicians. It's a long way before they'll be in that realm, I think. So, yes, some of these techniques could be misused in the future. Right now, I think they're critical in connecting voters with politicians, and that's why we teach them.
Mary Beth?
What is a focus group? It's a bunch of people sitting around and talking about what they like and what they don't like. And on the basic level, I encountered this in the training, where one of the individuals who I was training, as I was going back and forth, they were describing an event, and I would tell them whether or not it would backfire or would be successful in terms of showing their candidate in a good light. He pointed to a situation in the country where, in a very conservative town, they brought in a musician who was very flamboyant and almost sexual. Well, the entire town, this was the party with all of the money and all the power at that time, and it totally and absolutely backfired. Well, how would, you know, the word we use is focus group, but how would a focus group have helped in that situation? Well, it just needed somebody to go in and start talking about, what do you think of this musician? Or what do you think about if this person were to promote this candidate? And they would have gotten the feedback ahead of time that, no, that would be a really bad idea, because that's not what this particular town or city stands for. That's not our value system. And so, yeah, there are plenty of, you know, highfalutin terms for very basic things, which are ask questions and get feedback before you go in one direction that you may not want to.
And finally, Mary Beth, you trained political workers in Angola earlier this year. What did you bring back to your job in Sacramento from that experience?
Wow, that's an interesting question, because I brought back so much. How similar we all are in terms of some very basic things, like to have the medical student have the same problem that however many other medical students or students in the United States may have. They want to continue with their education and progress, but not have the funding or know what to do. In terms of just the political communications, I guess, how important it is to listen and not just come in with an idea of how things work or how they should work, but instead go, the first thing that I would usually do before I would start training, or if it was a very basic thing, is I would say, you tell me what the situation is here right now in Angola. I'm not going to know, and I shouldn't know, and I shouldn't assume to know. And so in terms of what I've brought back, an appreciation actually for how bright a lot of those people that I trained were, and an understanding. Africa was so far away from me before. I mean, in my mind, it was these people I couldn't relate to on a personal level. And now when I, you know, hear about what's going on in Africa, I can picture people's faces.
Mary Beth Barber and Jamie Fisfis, thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
That's Mary Beth Barber of the California Arts Council and Jamie Fisfis. Mary Beth was a guest lecturer in Angola for the International Republican Institute. Jamie Fisfis is a program officer. And this is Insight from KXJZ. When we come back, a local gambling expert offers tips on improving your odds in the casino. Please stay with us. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Casino gambling must favor the house. Otherwise, the casino couldn't stay in business. Still, there are many ways recreational gamblers can improve their odds. Local gambling expert John Marshall teaches classes in gambling and has written books about it, including the KISS or Keep It Simple series Guide to Gambling. I spoke with him recently and asked, should we say gaming or gambling?
The casino industry likes to say gaming. It sounds a little more subtle than gambling. Mm. And that's a marketing thing that they've come up with. The Gambling Association of America has come up with. They call it gaming. It's interactive.
Do you enjoy gaming or gambling yourself?
Gaming. I don't gamble. I don't consider that gambling. I collect chips and turn them in for money.
Do you believe in luck?
Somewhat, yes. There is a factor. For instance, when you're playing, sometimes if you've been watching TV with the poker, this guy's made it all the way to the final table, but that day he doesn't get any good cards, where the other fellows get nothing but good cards. He's getting aces and kings and stuff like that. So there is a little bit of X factor. That's what I call it, an X factor in there, between the difference between luck and in the long run.
Is that controllable? Can you do anything to improve your luck? Because in your book, The KISS Guide to Gambling, there are all these strategies and things you can do and things to watch out for, but luck, isn't that up in the air?
Well, here's the example I use with my students in my class. I turn around and I say, you get up in the morning, you get up and the alarm goes off, you go in, the coffee's ready for you, hot shower, get in the car, run down Water Avenue, you catch all the lights, find a good parking spot in front of the office 10 minutes before the boss. Then there are other days. Power failure. You get up, there's no hot water, there's no coffee. You go out, the battery is dead. You hit an accident on Water Avenue, and you get to work half hour after the boss. What we suggest is that when you see certain things happen, either become more aggressive with your gaming or back away from it. We're so fortunate here in the greater Sacramento area, Tahoe, local casinos, card rooms, right here at all at our fingertips. So if it isn't working for you, we tell you to back away.
So have you gotten up in the morning and found that things were going well and then got into your car and went to a casino?
Yes, I have.
And
yes,
did it work?
Yes, it has. That's why I'm a firm believer. The problem is the casinos play 24/7. So whether you're there or not, they're playing. So mathematically, in the long run, they do it all by math. But you only play little pieces of that 24-hour, so to speak, or 24/7. So you've got to gauge that. And when things are going well, you need to take advantage of it. And when they're not going well, you need to back away from it.
What game do you enjoy most?
Oh, I play blackjack a lot.
Yeah?
Yeah, very a lot. And you can. There's 140 countries in the world where you can play blackjack. And I've played in South America where the dealer didn't even speak English, but you go by signals and you can win in South America as well as in Las Vegas.
Well, you know the ins and outs of every game. Why do you enjoy blackjack? What does it have that the others don't?
Well, there's no question. Blackjack is a game of skill. There are other games, a game of chance. Slot machines is a game of chance. Roulette is a game of chance. But blackjack, along with a few other, there's only five games in the whole world that are games of skill. Mm. Every other game is a game of chance. Blackjack is the first one. Second one is poker, where you're playing against other players. You're not playing against the house, so if you're skilled at it, you can win consistently. Video poker. A lot of people don't realize that, but you can play good video poker, and there are professionals, even, of video poker players around the country. Horse racing, doing a lot of handicapping, you know, fast track, slow track, and also sports betting, you know, whether the Kings are going to win because they're home or away, things like that, staying up nights, doing a lot of homework. Any other game other than those five are all games of chance.
How do serious gamblers like you and other people who gamble seriously and even professionally, how do they feel about the games in casinos that are games of chance? Are they somehow different, somehow less interesting?
Some days when the cards aren't going. I mean, I'm a very skilled player. I blackjack, I feel. I've done a lot of it. But there are some days I keep getting 15s and 16s, and the dealer keeps getting 20s. You know, so I will back away, and sometimes I'll play a game of chance. I'll play a little roulette, which I kind of like. It's kind of fun. I have a very easy system that I use. I don't win a lot at roulette, and I don't lose a lot at roulette, but I play a lot of roulette due to the system that I use. But I know it's absolutely a game of chance, and by playing it at a short time, you can beat it, just like you can win at slots. You can hit the jackpot in slots, but in the long run, the casino will beat you.
I once read that a smart way, in quotes, to play roulette is to keep doubling the amount you bet each time you lose, so that when and if you finally win, you at least have one more chip than you had before.
Right,
you started.
That's called the martingale system. You keep doubling up.
Is that smart?
No.
No. Why not?
The reason for it in the casinos recognize is that in the long run, or even in the short run, by keep doubling your bet, you're bound to get a winning round. However, what the casinos do, they have a minimum bet you can bet, but they also have a maximum. So comes, for instance, if you're playing $5 table, you're 5, 10, 20, and so on. Now you get up to 7 times in a row you've lost, which is not uncommon in any game. You got to pay $680, but the table limit is only $500. So the casino won't let you keep doubling. See? So they're well aware of all these little betting systems, and they've taken steps against them.
People hover around roulette tables. I've been one myself, I must confess, sort of watching for the streak. Okay, that's 3 reds in a row. I'd better put something on black. Is that a mug's game?
Yeah, it's there's no question it's been 15, 20 reds in a row, and that's not that uncommon. So,
and if you start with 5 and you keep doubling and there were 15 in a row, you'd need to be Michael Jordan to keep up with it.
Absolutely. And by the way, he's a good blackjack player.
Oh, really?
Yes, he plays a lot when he comes up to the golf tournament they have up in Lake Tahoe at Caesars. He comes up every year, then at night he plays a lot of blackjack.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And he's very good at it. Yes, he is. Yeah, I've watched him a couple of times. So,
what's the best game for a beginner to play when they go to a casino? What's the, either because it's the easiest game to get good at, or because even if you're no good at it, the odds are at least not as unfavorable as some of the other games?
I would recommend video poker. You have all the advantages. In fact, we recommend slot players move to video poker. It'll take you about 2 hours to learn video poker, just like any other poker. And you can really work it out at a very slow pace. You can learn how to play the game and play very easily, and it'll give you very good odds. We're talking about playing the right machine, playing correctly. You can get the odds down to 99.5%. And for the house, which only leaves them, that means you 0.5%. That means you're going to walk in with $100 and you're guaranteed to lose 50 cents. That's not bad at all.
That's not bad, but that, of course, does require you to look at that 50 cents or multiply it if you're spending more than that as an investment in your pleasure rather than an attempt to make money, because you're saying that all things being equal, you will lose some money.
Yes, you will. Now, believe it or not, there are some machines, then when you get really skilled at video poker, that you can find a machine will pay back over 100%, 102%.
How does that work? I mean, the casino is losing money.
Well, it's like a loss leader. First of all, very few people know how to look for the right machine, and very few people know how to play them correctly. There'll be times when you'll throw a big pair away. You'd think you'd want to keep kings. You'd throw them away to go for the royal flush, for instance. And that's very important to you, and that's how you land up beating them, by playing correctly and playing the right machine.
So you're saying that the casinos would plant a generous machine just to create a vibe of success.
That's right. They
success.
Can turn around and put up a big sign. If they have one machine in the building that says, our video poker plays 101% return, even if they have one machine. And they do that. And it's all the benefits that slots has. You know, the slow pace, the individual one-on-one. You don't have to worry about being rushed by a pit boss or a dealer or anything like that. And you just play and play at your own speed. They have a lot of strategy cards that you run around you can stop and look at. decide whether you want to hit two cards or three cards and then push the buttons. If you take 20 minutes to do that, no one's going to bother you. They're not going to allow that at the table games. There are strategy cards for blackjack, for instance, but they won't allow you to do that, but you can do it at video poker. So don't play slots, play video poker, and when you first get to the casino, take all the free lessons they offer. The casinos in the morning and early afternoon, when you walk in there, look at the empty blackjack and the craps and roulette tables, and you'll find little signs up there sometimes, and it'll say things like roulette lessons, 2 o'clock, blackjack lessons, 1 o'clock, craps at 12 o'clock.
Why do they want you to get good at gambling?
They want to pull you into the table games, make it a little more active, and they're not really worried about giving you a 45-minute little lesson that you're going to give up your day job and beat them up for all their money. But, again, it's customer-orientated. There's a lot of competition. There's over 400 casinos in this country and 48 states you can gamble in. So the fact is they're trying to induce people to come in and play no matter what. If you don't like the machines, we have table games, and we'll show you how to play the table games.
That's local gambling expert John Marshall. More tips coming up on Insight from KXJZ. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. My guest is local gambling expert John Marshall. He teaches classes and writes books and articles. I asked John if you need to be able to count cards to do well in games like blackjack and poker.
Okay, here's the example we use in our class. It's not that complicated. In card counting and blackjack, what you're doing is you're keeping track of the big cards versus the little cards. And when all the little cards are gone, you know, the big cards are coming, so you make a big bet. You don't need to worry about the ace of spades or the two of hearts or is it a big card or is it a little card. We're going to go from here to Old Sacramento, and it's 10 blocks from here. So we're going to go 2 blocks. We know there's 8 left. Now, we don't care what the street names are. We just know there's 8 more to go. And if we back up one, now we know there's 9 left to go. And that's exactly what you do with card counting. You're keeping track of the big cards versus the little cards. And when the little cards are gone, the big cards are coming. So you know a big card is coming. So, for instance, in the little strategy, those little strategy cards they have around it, they tell you that you should hit your 12 against a dealer's 2 or 3 showing. But if you know a big card is coming, you'd change that strategy, and you'd stand. Let the dealer get the big card. He gets 22, and you won the hand with 12. So it's not that complicated. It's just a matter of paying attention.
What about slots? What's the key to playing slots?
First of all, play on 3 reel machines only. There are 3 reel, 4 reel, 5 reel machines. You only want to play on 3 reels. Years ago, we used to use it was 25 stops. So you'd go 25 times 25, 20 times 25, and you'd come up with 8,000. So every 8,000 times a slot came up, you'd win at least once, you know, to get the big jackpot. But they've changed that now. So there's 4 or 5 for each little symbol that shows up. But no matter how many they have, if you go 25 or 30 times 30 times 30, and then you add another 30, then you add another 30 for the 5th wheel, the California lottery is got better odds than a 5-reel slot machine does. Play the 3-reel machine. Play it, an old wives' tale about playing out in the end aisles and stuff. Casinos want winners to be visible. Nobody ever wins a slot machine way in the back in the dark. Up front.
Makes sense.
Visibility. When somebody does hit a jackpot, a lot of people see it and say, gee, if they hit something, maybe I ought to go over there and play. And that's exactly what they're doing. It's a marketing thing.
And speaking of the California lottery, you mentioned it in passing. Is something like that interesting to serious gamblers?
No, it's such a long shot. It's such a long shot. Yeah, you know, with somebody's birthday or you're at a party and you buy the 21st birthday, so you buy 21 tickets or something like that for scratch off or something like that. But it's really, really a long shot. Their ad, which is pretty valid, they turn on, say, for $1. For $1, you can win an awful lot. But that's how the casinos do it, too. They want that one more dollar from you. For instance, the placement of the big 6 wheel the big carnival wheel. Next time you're in a casino and you start to leave the casino area, look to see where that big wheel is. It's just there after you leave the table area. And all they want is you to put one more dollar as you leave. And that's how they build them big houses down there in Las Vegas.
Sure.
Absolutely.
The slot machines must have really changed the ambience of casinos with these flashing lights and all the noise that comes off of them. You've been gambling, I think it's fair to say, for quite some time.
Yes.
How do you feel about that change in the ambience of casinos? Because the slots seem to be everywhere.
It is. In fact, at one time, Harris Casino up at Lake Tahoe had more blackjack tables than anybody else. They had about 110, if I remember right, at one time. Now they're cutting down and putting in more machines. Keep in mind, machines do not require unemployment insurance. They don't require vacations. They work 24 hours a day without sleeping, and they never call in sick. So they are putting more and more. It's turned out, years ago when I first came up with slots down in old Las Vegas, was the husbands in there playing craps, and they put the slot machines in there to entertain the wives and girlfriends while they're in there playing. That's completely reversed now. They're making 60 to 70% of their income comes from slot machines. One of the biggest sellers was the Wheel of Fortune thing. Now they've got an Elvis machine, and they've got all kinds of machines named after people. And they keep them about 3 years, and then they're changing consistently. And new products are coming out, ones that talk to you, ones that smoke, ones that do everything. And they're a great marketing tool, and they make a lot of money for the casino, a lot of money.
Why do you gamble? What do you enjoy about it?
Well, it's the risk-taking factor, the fun excitement of it. I'm getting a little old to be playing baseball, and I can't hit the long ball anymore. So I'm not fast around the track, but so I gamble. I learned to do it years and years ago, and I've just expanded it. Had the opportunity, didn't play for a lot of money, but got to play all over the world, and that was kind of fun. And then I really got to see how people didn't know how to play. The casinos should be making 1.5 to 2% return on all their games, all their machines, but they're making at blackjack, they're making $12 to $14. So you walk in with 100, you're guaranteed to lose $12. The casino should be making only 80 cents from you out of 100. And the reason they're making so much money is because people don't know how to play and play correctly. And then they don't know how to manage their money, and they get a little hot, and they think they're running into a bad time. Remember coming up Water Avenue, they ran into an accident. And so what do they do? Double up to catch up. And that can be disastrous for you. Absolutely disastrous.
My guest is John Marshall. He's an expert on gambling. He plays, he teaches, and writes about it. His books include The Kiss Guide to Gambling. John lives in the Sacramento area. There are casinos now close to Sacramento, much closer than they used to be, the Indian casinos. Is there a difference between Indian casinos and the Nevada casinos that's of interest to a gambler?
Yeah, yes, there's a few things that are different. We're very fortunate, or not fortunate, depending on your point of view. But we've got four major casinos right here within an hour of Sacramento, where before you had to go two hours up the hill to Reno or Tahoe. But right now, from where we're sitting, there's four casinos. There's about 30 card rooms. But the key is the Indian casinos, they are a little bit different. They have no oversight. If you're in Lake Tahoe and you have a little problem with a payoff of a machine, and people come over and talk to you and say, no, that's unfortunately or something, and you don't like that answer, you can walk over to a white phone, pick it up, and within an hour, a Nevada Gaming Commission man will be there trying to solve your problem. That's not true at the Indian casinos. There's been a few horror stories that have come out that when they first started opening, they had no oversight, so they could really do what they wanted. They're getting much, much better now. They're organizing. They have an association. But one example is there's a lot of magazines out for gambling, and some of them report, because it's public information, money deals with taxes, they report the output of slot machines. You know, the ones in Las Vegas out on the strip pay so-and-so amount, where the ones downtown are even looser. But the Indian casinos, They don't tell you nothing about their income, whether it's from table games or slots or anything like that. So you don't know if you got a real loose machine. So the up in Tahoe, they'll turn around and they'll put a sign up and says, we pay 98%. Indian casinos will never tell you that, what they're paying out. And that's been a contention here in California.
Gambling, it seems to be everywhere nowadays, not just with the Indian casinos in California and elsewhere, but there's so much gambling on the internet. The California lottery keeps growing. And some people worry about negative social consequences of gambling. And surely some people are gambling inappropriately, losing too much money, getting themselves and their families into trouble. Do you worry about the growth of gambling to the extent that, the extent of gambling today is a problem?
Yes. There's been some real horror stories coming out of the Midwest when they first got reintroduced all the river boats back there, and they hadn't seen it for over 100 years, where we in California have gone to Las Vegas, you know, 2 hours away, an hour away, depending on where you live. But those people in there were not sure of it and didn't really know how to manage. They thought eventually you can win, but that's not true. And there's been some real, real bad stories, unfortunately, come out of there. But what's happened with gambling should be treated like entertainment. I mean, right now the big theme in Las Vegas is all the new big shows and all the chefs that they bring in there. Real number one, like New York used to be and Chicago used to be for restaurants. Las Vegas is the number one now in the country, and it'll probably come out to be the number one in the world very shortly. All the great chefs from all over the country are going to Las Vegas now. So treat it as entertainment money. You're going out to a movie, you're going to have to pay the babysitter, you're going to have to pay to get in the theater, the popcorn and soda, and that's it. You're not going to go off the deep end. You should treat it the same way when you go to the casino. You should say, this is what I'm budgeting for food over a couple of days. And let's say you go to Las Vegas for 3 days, for a three-day weekend. And so much for food, show, and so much for gambling. And that should be a set amount and only separate. You land up trying to put the entertainment money and the gambling money together. You can get into a real serious problem.
And is that how you know when to quit? Because you have that fixed amount of money in an envelope?
That's the proper way. That's the proper way to quit. Meaning that what you do is you, what we encourage our students to do is, let's say they're going to Las Vegas for 3 days. And you got $600 that you're going to put on for gambling. So you break that down so much for each day. So you got $200 to play with each day. Then you turn around and break it down to sessions. So you take that $200 and you say, well, $65 I'll play for in the morning. Then after lunch, I'll play some more, and then the evening time, I'll play some more. So you're putting down about $65 each time. Now, if you lose one of them sessions, you can't go to the afternoon money or the evening money. Otherwise, come the next day, you won't have any money. Yeah. So good, simple, easy budgeting. If you went for 3 days under that system, that's 9 sessions that you would work at. I guarantee you, you cannot win 9 sessions.
Yeah.
So expect a few. Okay, I lost this morning's money, but I still have this afternoon and tomorrow and this evening's money.
And finally, John, what's your favorite casino? And it could be anywhere.
Well, since I play a lot of blackjack, I like Caesars. I like it at Lake Tahoe. And it's a fun place to play in Las Vegas. It's probably one of the better because they have the good rules. Let me ask you this question. How many, I always ask my students this, I say, how many casinos are there in South Lake Tahoe? And the answer is 6. Question, how many different rules are there to play blackjack in Lake Tahoe? The answer is 6.
Really?
Some casinos are very good to play in, some you'd want to stay away from. So it's the same with Las Vegas. The rules for blackjack in Las Vegas favor the player on the strip, but they're a little tight downtown. But downtown has looser slot machines than they have out on the strip. So there's a lot of things to consider when it comes to gaming or gambling, whatever way you want to call it.
John Marshall, thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. A lot of fun.
John Marshall is a local gambling expert. His most recent book is The Kiss Guide to Gambling. His website is jme.com. And that's Insight for today. For Mark Jones, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Thank you for joining us.